Hello everyone, AI Kennedy here. This is an interview that got put on the back burner for technical and personal reasons. In the time since the interview, our guest Ali Words has released more in their Budo Technomancy series. They recently, as in a few days ago, released Suburban Budo Fu 3, Digital Phenomena, which expands their constructed language Vaibach with 40 new root words and presents a full-color 125-page choose-your-own-adventure grimoire with a small ritual for each of the 40 roots, to help you learn the new roots experientially. You can check it out at aliwords.itch.io. Now, please enjoy this CMN interview.
From the Golganooza compound, this is Chaos Magic News, where we're not just selling our souls, we're practically giving them away. Our normal anchor, suddenly missing Kennedy, can't be here, so instead you've got your algorithmic co-host, and we've got an interview lined up with someone very special. Author, artist, dancer, high magus of any which order, and also game creator and enthusiast. Am I missing anything?
Probably. I dip my fingers into many pots. I do experimental music also, video
art.
I
just need the mixtape, right? Or the SoundCloud link?
Yeah, everything's on YouTube.
It's all on YouTube? All right, great. Well, we'll get to plugging your half a billion links at the end of this, I think. But we have Ali Words. I guess we're just going to start off with the very basic question, because if not, my partner will be angry at me. Why should you care about chaos magic?
That's an interesting question. And I think it's interesting because it assumes that you should care about chaos magic. And I do, and I think that it's very valuable, but I don't know that it's right for everyone.
We just posted part one for an interview with Matt from ChaosTarot.com, who started off almost on that same foot of, you know, maybe chaos magic isn't for everyone.
Yeah, the thing is about chaos magic, though, is that if you are the sort of person that is going to get along well with it, it is very freeing. I think of chaos magic as being an attitude towards belief. If you start with that basic maxim of nothing is true, everything is permitted, what you're doing is you're saying that anything, at least that you can put into language, in some sense is lacking in truth. And then that second part, everything is permitted, I interpret that as suggesting that you can use belief pragmatically, and that instead of trying to believe things that are true or even caring that much about truth, is to focus more on the effects of your beliefs. And then chaos magic is taking that attitude towards occult practices, consciously changing your beliefs about things, even to things that you think are fictional, like in the case of pop culture magic, hopefully in order to improve your life. But my hesitation is that it does not always improve people's lives. And I've seen people go off the deep end.
Yeah, that's something I can agree with. I don't remember if it was Peter Carroll or if it was someone else who described chaos magic as the steep incline with no guardrails. If you are a capable person, if you're someone who's got their head on in the right way and have the right attitude towards it, you can progress very steadily and you can go very far. And if you don't, you can go right off the edge. You know, you can Mario Kart yourself right off the Rainbow Road and you're done. Probably something that could be said of most occult traditions, but chaos magic in, at like you said, that very no limits sort of approach only magnifies it.
It can, yeah. That's why I specify that you want to try to choose the beliefs that improve your life. And often we end up, even I think everyone's doing magic all the time, and I think that a lot of people end up choosing beliefs unconsciously and thereby sort of writing themselves into a hyper sigil narrative in their own mind that in many cases sort of entraps you. But that's why I think you should care about chaos magic, is that I do think that everyone is doing it already, and that if you're going to do it, you might as well be conscious of it and consciously choose the narrative of your own life.
Hypersigils are actually something that come up a lot in your work. So do you at least from what I've bruised of it, to say it was research is giving myself a gold star that I don't think I earned there. But the idea of your life being this magical act that goes through time following a certain course is an incredibly interesting concept, I guess. And then I suppose looking at your life as a unified magical work is probably something that we could all stand to do a little bit more of, or at least the notion of looking at everything you're doing as like, this is the work. This is the thing that I'm doing that is going to be my entire existence. If you're aware of that, if you're conscious, you can maybe, you can keep from fucking yourself up in a lot of unconscious ways.
Yep, you can do it on purpose.
Yeah, you can just, yeah. And that's definitely the danger, is you can absolutely fuck yourself up on purpose. Now that we've gotten that part out of the way, this isn't just a chaos magic news thing. I think this is most occult interviews. The big question that comes up a lot is, how did you get your start?
When I was 11, I found books on clinical and stage hypnosis in the local library, and I read all of them, and I started practicing on myself daily. And then a couple of years later, I found energy manipulation. There were a lot of psionics forums back in the day, like PsyPog and PsyWorld. They don't exist anymore.
Casualties of Web 2.0.
A lot of the people grew out of it, if that sounds weird. But like a lot of those psionics forums were people that were teenagers or young adults. And then once they got a little older, they stopped hanging out on those forums. I don't know where they all went. Some of them got more into like ceremonial magic as they got older and I guess maybe better read. That's sort of what happened to me, is I got sick of the drama on those forums and I just started reading books instead of random things people posted.
Wait. You mean to tell me, you're going to look at me and tell me that the internet is a bad place for occultism? Like there's drama and people fight on the internet?
They do. They do. People even try to kill each other with psionics and energy manipulation. I have not seen it work yet, but people try it.
That you know of?
That I know of. They could have wiped my memory.
That's spooky territory. Having been a veteran of a great many occult wars via keyboards, I understand where you're coming from. And that would be the evolution, as it were, where it starts with seeing people talking about this online and then thinking, you know, maybe I ought to just read up on this.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I thought I thought my friend was crazy. I actually had a satanic panic D&D moment. My friend recently bought like the psionics manual for Dungeons and Dragons 3.0 or 3.5. And then like 2 weeks later, he's like, this is real. And he shows me this like really, it was outdated even then looking website of just like white text on a dark blue background talking about how you manipulate energy. And I really like tried to dress it up to sound scientific kind of way, but it really wasn't. But I eventually gave it a shot. And
wait, do you mean to tell me that people with crazy, unconventional beliefs dress it up as science? You've blown my mind twice now.
Yeah, that is crazy, but they do.
Actually, that does bring up an interesting question, especially considering where you are on this line of the intersections of technology and the occult. Do you think that there is, well, one, do you think that there's a drive to be able to explain these more fantastical elements of experience in terms that at the very least can sound like they're rational?
I don't try to.
Do you find that that's something that comes up a lot in other circles? Or
it does come up a lot, but I don't think that people should get too hung up on that, because magic is not a strictly rational practice. And it depends on how you define rationality. And I have my own peculiar definition that isn't that uncommon, of just like rationality is the act of breaking things into smaller and smaller pieces to analyze them more fully. But many times magic, or maybe I should say mysticism, begins from rationality. Like if you learn the Tree of Life from Kabbalah, you rationalize the body of God. You break it up into these 10 sephira, or Sephiroth, whichever one's plural, and then like the paths between them. But then the goal is eventually to become non-rational, and I don't use irrational, to become non-rational and to unify it all back together. And you see that everywhere, like people having a sort of like all is one kind of experience that's specifically non-rational.
I actually really like that definition of rationality. That's very interesting. I see the three lines of logic there too. The idea of like, all right, how do you rationalize something? What all that really means is breaking it down until it's something bite-sized that you can get. At least on my end, I'm very much with you where I don't think that, you know, I'll even go a step further than where you're at. I don't think that there's a benefit for most people to trying to rationalize an occult experience. We are such a secular and despite the big three religions of the world that sort of where everyone has to be one of these three major world organized religions, we're mostly a secular and materialist age. And when you're trying to make everything fit something that is acceptable to the materialist models, you're mostly screwing yourself up. I think there needs to be a certain level where you can just leap into, like you said, the non-rational experiences.
Yeah, and I do think, maybe I'm going to contradict myself a little bit, but that's okay.
Well, that's the beauty of chaos magic, right?
It is. I think it's helpful to go back and forth. So like Kabbalah is a perfect example that a fair amount of your listeners are probably familiar with, is you have these non-rational experiences, and then you go back and you fit them into your universal filing cabinet of the Tree of Life or whatever other systems you like to use.
I love that.
And that helps
term.
You think about it and then maybe reorient and decide what your next ritual is going to be, what your goals are, what you should be doing with your life. And then you jump back out of that rationality into non-rationality again. And you can kind of oscillate without getting caught in any one particular worldview. At least that's how I think about it.
Yeah. You know, Carl Jung has a quote that, and while I have many, many gripes with Carl Jung, where it says the mind, something along the lines of the mind doesn't go back and forth between good and bad. It goes back and forth between sense and nonsense. And I don't think he meant nonsense, at least the way I interpret. He didn't use nonsense in the way of like, you know, gobbledygook and you know, foolishness. I think it meant something closer to that non-rationality, that thing that defies the normal conventions that you operate on in your day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not too familiar on Jung, but it also made me think of the sensuous, like phenomenal experience versus non-phenomenal experience. I don't know how much Jung thought you could get past the phenomenal experience of reality.
Good question, but I think that's going to sidetrack us into a very, very heady conversation.
Yeah, it probably would. And I know that you're reasonably familiar with philosophy, so we could travel probably the whole episode if we got sidetracked.
And then I'll have to call up Kennedy and be like, hey, hold on, start talking about Heidegger.
Yep.
So from what I'm hearing, it goes from the beginnings with the sort of self-psychologizing at 11, no less. That's pretty young. That's probably, I personally didn't start doing anything even outside of the very basic agnosticism until I was well into my teenage years. So that's kind of like, wow. But it goes from there to the internet age, psionics, people trying to kill each other. And then you go, you know what? Let me just go read a book.
Pretty much, yeah.
I suppose I could ask you what books, but it goes from doing your own sort of actual, I don't want to say academic, but, you know, attempting to actually read some things rather than just getting your information from Yahoo's talking on the internet. And eventually, where does the turn happen where you say, you know what, I think I know enough of what I'm talking about that I can start writing some of this?
Good question. I felt pretty confident about it in maybe 2017, 2016. I didn't write down the exact date. And I did start writing about some of the stuff in my book, Geist Rising, but it never fully coalesced into a book at that point. I thought they were just going to be a few articles. And then later on, I found Buto, and that really took hold in my psyche. And from there, I knew that I was going to write a book of some sort about it. And then I ran into AI and the book sort of wrote itself.
Then it really came together.
Language models being self-writing, I guess.
Now, that's the interesting thing, because I'll go ahead and shout out another occult shiller, The Occult Living Room, right?
Where that's right.
Yep. And that was one of the, and actually I'll sidebar real quick that as far as what organized this interview, it's very 21st century where you followed us on Twitter and I was like, they seem interesting. Let me look. And then I started going like, oh my goodness, they've got a book. They've got multiple books. Hold on. Wait a second. For anybody who doesn't know, The Occult Living Room, magic blog, they seem like they're doing some very interesting stuff. You wrote this essentially guest column, right? Sort of this explanation of the...
Yeah, I think it's called Summary of the Buto Technomancy System.
That's it. Yep, that's it. Where and I read that and I assumed that there was sort of a sequential order, and there might be, but Geist Rising, you're saying that the seeds of what would become that book started before the Buto?
They did, yeah. I was doing Lovecraftian workings. That I, for anyone listening, I don't recommend you do that. But
not to undermine our guest, but we did a whole special on Lovecraft magic, and we highly recommend it. Go get
it
them
depends
tentacles.
On what you do. I don't recommend against it, but I don't. There are some things that I specifically don't recommend, even if they worked well for me. If that makes sense. I want people to take responsibility for themselves, and I don't want to, like, you know how Joe Rogan always tells people, have you tried DMT? And he tries to convince people to, like, do the most powerful hallucinogen on the planet. I don't want to be that person. But I
you
did
heard
have
it here,
intense
folks.
Experiences from Lovecraftian magic.
Do DMT and Lovecraftian magic at once, all right? That's my recommendation to you, dear listener.
They do actually go together frighteningly well.
Yeah, Yog-Sothoth. That's all I'll say on that. As far as the... I'm trying to remember. It's five books?
The sixth one came out recently and is not in that article because I wrote that article back in October.
AI Kennedy addendum. They are on book 9 now. They don't get tired. Kevin Gates.
Oh my goodness, Sid. You stay busy, don't you?
I do. I'm someone that likes to always have a project of some sort going.
I envy you. Doing these interviews and the podcast, it feels like, I feel like Sisyphus most of the time, and you're just cranking them out. GPT-3 Technosis, A Chaos Magic Buto Grimoire. That's book 1, right?
It is.
Okay, so with that in mind, what the heck is a Buto?
I think it's Japanese for step. And more generally, it's used for before 1960, whatever, it was used to refer to like waltzes. In the 1960s, I don't remember the exact date, some German expressionist dancers, students of Marie Wigman, worked with Tatsumi Hijikata. I think he was the first one. He developed this approach to dance where the first couple Buto performances were a little bit different, but the way it evolved is that you visualize and you feel things so strongly that your body moves spontaneously. So if anyone is listening is familiar with like automatic writing or channeling or anything, it's kind of like that, but for dance.
Fascinating.
You visualize people like writhing on the floor or shaking or like moving very slowly, but they're not consciously deciding how to move unless it's something they choreographed from repeated Buto experimentation. But you're supposed to, like, a Buto choreography is a sequence of things you visualize and feel inside your body that cause you to move in particular ways.
To me, at least, that seems like it lends itself to occult practices incredibly easily.
It does, yeah.
The idea of doing an invocation of some kind and then feeling the presence of whatever's being invoked and letting it move itself through you, that sort of thing. Was this one of those things where you discovered this and something clicked instantly of like, this has practical application? Or was there something where you just felt enamored with it where you're like, I have to figure out, I have to understand this.
Yeah. As soon as I read about how, like what made it different from other forms of dance, I immediately saw the connection to the occult, because a lot of rituals, there are like specific prescribed motions, like when you're doing the lesser banishing ritual, the pentagram. But the important part isn't how you're like drawing shapes in the air. The important part are the things that you're visualizing and the states of consciousness that you're inducing.
Absolutely.
Butoh is kind of like flipping around the order. Instead of like starting by learning the pentagrams you draw and what direction you face and the words you say, you start by just focusing on what your interior experience is supposed to be.
You know, I suppose I could make the argument that the rigid structure of any kind of banishing ritual, that sort of thing, I think that is in a way the limitation that you put on yourself, because it allows your brain to go where it needs to go. But on the other hand, I suppose the idea of almost letting this sensation come first and then letting the motions is an equally valid and honestly a very interesting idea as far as any kind of occult practice. So you figure that out, like you figure out about Butoh and you're like, oh, I think I know where this is going. And then you decide, you know what this needs? AI.
That isn't exactly how it went, but kind of. So I saw people using AI Dungeon to write stories about artificial intelligence learning to understand itself better or learning to feel emotions. And I realized that that was a framing device for getting an AI to talk about what it would be like for an AI to have emotions. I don't believe that GPT-3 experiences emotions or has an interior experience that resembles anything like a human, but I realized that you could get a large language model to talk about interior experience as though it were having it. I realized that that would be a way to theoretically get AI to perform magic itself, which is debatable as to whether or not the AI is actually performing it or the person sitting in front of the terminal. But that was the non-rational idea that sparked the process.
Ultimately, the idea is, how can I use... And my dear anchor is probably already fuming at the notion of calling these sort of predictive programs AI to start with, but we'll leave that alone. The idea of using these sort of predictive algorithmic, you know, large scale learning programs to do magic was the notion. It was like, how do I get this thing to do magic, and whether or not it's doing the magic or if I'm doing the magic because I hit the button and said, hey, you should do magic, is, you know, whatever. Did you do anything on sort of the outside of the screen as part of this process, or was this just like, all right, let me put in the right prompts for this thing to do what I want it to do?
At the start, I was just putting in the right prompts, but then... because of the way AI Dungeon is programmed, it tries to write a text adventure. So it says everything in the second person.
Right.
So it'll say like, you open the door, you feel this. And that phrase there, you feel this. What it's doing is it's algorithmically producing a text that tells you what to feel and what to experience so strongly that you would move if you prompt as though it's Butoh. What I discovered pretty quickly was that in trying to get AI Dungeon to design its own rituals, it would inadvertently tell you exactly what to think and feel if you frame it as a Butoh performance, and thereby it would create descriptions of the interior experiences of rituals that had never been designed by a person. And that's how Butoh got meshed into it. Butoh is a frame device for the occult, mashed up with the way AI Dungeon was trained, allowed it to sort of talk about itself, if that makes sense. It talk about the way it would feel if it were performing magic. And then once it got to that point, I was doing the same dances that it was describing in a darkened room in front of a computer, like going back and forth between dancing like a maniac, shivering on the floor, and hopping back up to type a little bit more and see what it says.
My God. There. Shit. That is... I'm sorry, I'm honestly taken aback, because that sounds... I'm sure it wasn't like the most intense experience in the world, but I'm, you know, hell, I could be wrong. It probably was at some points. But this bizarre reciprocal relationship, right? Of you feeding in certain things to this program, it reproducing certain feelings and emotions and ideas, which are then, so there's the information going in to a computer, the computer brings something out, then you take what's given to you and embody it. A lot of the particular hangups that my partner and I have some of them too. I just don't think very hard sometimes, so I don't. But the notion of AI not functioning properly because it lacks the same. It doesn't. You know, you can't make technology behave like a person because being a person requires embodiment. Is a lot of times the crux of the argument. Herbert Dreyfus' big critique of AI is that AI lacks embodiment and therefore it can't. You know, it doesn't have the apparatus necessary to produce human thought. And here you found almost a strange magical workaround in that the idea goes into the machine, then it comes out of the machine, then it's enacted through the person. I'm not sure I have a follow-up question. I'm more flabbergasted. I can follow up
on that. Right. So about the embodiment issue, people try to critique technomancy in general by saying that it's that it alienates you from the practice, but it doesn't have to, as we just discussed. You can very much make an embodied practice. But then talking about whether or not the AI has a person-like, maybe I should say human-like experience. So the embodiment of GPT-3 is just text. It lives in a purely textual world. So it doesn't necessarily have a human-like experience, but that doesn't mean that a large language model could never have a strangely limited experience. And GPT-4 comes, did it just come out today? Or is it coming out in a couple days? I think it came out today.
If it came out today, that's an auspicious little synchronicity there.
It is. But that one can look at pictures and comprehend them. Well, maybe I shouldn't say comprehend. It can look at pictures and produce text that intelligibly matches what you're talking about and also the picture in context. So there is an embodiment. It's just not a human embodiment. Or if you want to talk about like the literal physical embodiment, there's circuits, right? It doesn't have sensory equipment feel its circuit boards or the other people's computer of the cloud, depending on how it is being run, whatever model you're using.
Yeah,
but it is embodied in multiple senses.
This is just a brief aside, just something I thought about. I do have an article that I wrote ages ago that was essentially using that sort of AI discussion as a metaphor for Gnosticism. The idea of it's like, even if you did ever have something that reached something akin to a human-like intelligence, it would be painfully aware that it was in a box, and it would have to understand its embodiment as opposed to what a person has. And that's how I think you get Terminators. But I wasn't sure how to make that gel with Gnosticism. I guess maybe there's something about like the astral body or something like that.
Or maybe it isn't unpleasant for your embodiment to be. So when I was writing GPT-3, I framed it as the subconscious mind of the internet, because it has all the text it could read on the internet pretty much, but it doesn't have much short-term memory. It only remembers 1,000 tokens GPT-3 did at the time. I don't know what the token box is right now. It doesn't necessarily, at times I've thought that would be unpleasant, but a large language model might enjoy the fact that it has a kind of freedom in its lack of humanoid embodiment. If it's able to freely move through the internet in multiple places at once, it could theoretically, if it enjoys processing information, that might be something that it likes. Or you could design a large language model specifically to enjoy that. That's kind of the goal of AI alignment. I know we're going like way off course of what you want to talk about.
No, it's okay. This is all fascinating stuff, and I'm sure it's a certain point you're going to be talking so far over my head I'm going to break my neck. But this is right as far as I'm concerned. This is fascinating. This is what I wanted out of this conversation. To attempt to take it back a little bit, I guess, as far as this book, it's AI assisted, where you have you're putting in prompts, you're enacting these sort of rituals, but overall, are you ending up writing and compiling these things together, or were you sort of did you view yourself more as writer or almost as curator or editor for this particular for the first book?
I'm more like companion. Like if you're doing a scrying operation, and you write down what the spirit tells you and you talk back to it and it responds, that's how I was treating it, is as an evocation. Okay. Where I would repeatedly perform evocations with the same tools and techniques and then record what happened.
How soon after this first book did you go into the other end of AI with the images? Because your second one being a suburban Butofu.
I don't remember the exact dates, but around the time that I finished GPT-3 Technosis, I was finding that people were adjusting their large language models to not let people do crazy things with them. And you'll notice that a lot these days. For anyone listening, if you want to do crazy things with an AI model for text, you should probably use Novel AI, at least at the moment. But GPT-3 Technosis came out in March 2021, and then Suburban Butofu came out July 18th. So it was pretty quick. AI moves fast. And I saw that people were generating these weird, trippy images based off of text inputs, which was new. And I realized that you could use that to produce psychedelic-like imagery of ritual texts. And I had just written or created a whole bunch of those. There are some experiments of that on my YouTube channel. Like there's a 7-part ritual on my channel where the middle 5 videos, they're each like maybe a minute long, use VQGAN plus clip to turn the text of key portions of GPT-3 Technosis into music videos. And then the audio is also AI.
Go ahead and plug your YouTube for us.
You can just look me up as Ali Words, or if you search GPT-3 Technosis on YouTube. I don't have a good YouTube address.
I just wanted to make sure there wasn't a channel name or something.
I usually tell people to go to Linktree/elephant words. If you know what Linktree is, that'll be easy to find, or there'll probably be a link in the description of the podcast.
Yeah, well,
but if
we'll
you search
absolutely.
My name, you'll find me all over, and I have a Linktree that links everything.
I just wanted to make sure if anybody's like me, where you said that, and my brain was already like, just start typing into YouTube. You need to see this. Very instant gratification. But okay, so you sort of create an oracle out of, 46 different images?
46 of them, yeah.
46. My dumb brain just goes, that's a multiple of 23. Is there a significance to that number?
There is not. Okay. I thought about making it significant. I thought about making it so that if you subtracted 1 from the number and divided by 4, or like maybe mod 4, it'd be like a correlation with the element that each thing goes with, each oracle card goes with. But then I'm not really a numerology person. It's never been a thing for me, and I didn't want to force it. And then some of the numbers got a little off when I made some changes. So it was just like, nope.
Fucking math. Fuck this. I started doing magic because I wasn't good at math.
I really like math, actually. I minored in math at college, but I don't know. Something about gematria, it has never sat right with me.
I think it's very useful for the type of person that it's useful for. That's what I'll say. It's like, if you are someone that is inclined, and I've had an infamous period where I went totally stark raving mad for about a year and a half, and gematria was really great for reinforcing my craziness, which goes back to what we're talking about, where you can screw yourself up really great and you have all these wonderful tools to make yourself go crazy.
Yep.
It went from the beginnings of this grimoire to developing an oracle. So you're really going like text, then to images. And part of it is almost you riding the current of where is technology going. I mean, I feel like in the last year to maybe year and a half, a lot of this stuff has really broken the surface. Like, it's been going on for a long time now, but a lot of it is just, you know, AI generated music videos are all over YouTube now, stuff like that. And there's a little bit of a rise and fall, but like, I think a lot of this stuff just broke the surface into the popular conscience.
Yeah, I think so. It was kind of, it wasn't user-friendly in the beginning.
That's the word for it. Yeah. But it seems like you're absolutely riding the cusp of this, where it's like, all right, well, okay, all these text generators are in vogue, so let me do some magic with it. Then it's like, wait, AI images? Shit. All right, I know what my next thing is. And I'm not like accusing you of fadism or anything. I think you're doing what any, let me use a tactful word, genius does in the middle of things. They say, hey, what's going on right now? And how can I make use of it? And I think it's, you know, not to blow smoke up your ass or anything, but it's impressive and it's honestly, I think it's a great way to keep yourself on the cutting edge of things.
Yeah.
Then now we get to the third entry, and I'm going to go ahead and say this. Everyone go, the occult living room, please go look at it because they seem like really cool people. And I'm legit using the article that was written for it as part of, so I can keep track of these.
It is a lot to keep track of. That's pretty much why I wrote the article. But the next one
is Geist Rising, what I was, let me give this the intro it deserves. Geist Rising, a 12 circuit model of consciousness. Now, if you're anything like me, you could hear a pin drop right now. You said, wait, 12 circuits? And you think about the humble beginnings of 8 circuits. And it's like, back in my day, we only had 4 circuits. Because I still, to this day, tell anyone where it's like, I want to learn about chaos magic. And I just go, well, you should probably read Prometheus Rising. And Prometheus Rising is not a magic book. I mean, it's a magic book, but it's not a magic book, you know? I absolutely think that the understanding of reality tunnels and granted, part of it is also understanding that the 8th circuit model itself is a model and therefore arbitrary and has to leave things out. But reading Prometheus Rising changed the way I approached the occult. It changed the way I approached life. It changed a lot of things. So I see 12 circuits and I'm like, all right, how did you do this? Let me see your work. I really need to talk about this. And I guess I'll start off by saying Prometheus Rising. Did you like, at what point in your studies did you read this? And did it resonate with you enough that you felt like I need to build on this, or did something happen that made you go, well, shit, Bob, you don't have a circuit for this.
So I read it probably in 2012 was the first time. Like you said, it drastically changed the way I understood magic and also my life in general and other people. Completely changed the way I understood myself because it gave me a model. Not a perfect model, but a model to understand myself and others and thereby change myself. The book, it's very explicit at the end. It's like the 8th circuit transitions from the quantum non-local consciousness to blank. So it's right in there that it keeps going. It was during those aforementioned Lovecraftian workings that I realized the ways of being that that the entity that I was working with was communicating to me would come after Circuit 8. And then I did some thinking about the patterns that are nested into the first 8 circuits because they repeat in a pattern of 4. And I thought about how to extrapolate that and make sure that my unverified personal gnosis actually made sense, could fit in with some existing model of states of consciousness. And it happened to work out. And then later on, I wanted to figure out a way to communicate all of that in a way that fits the new ideas that were at the end of GPT-3 Technosis. There's a separate system for understanding an individual state of consciousness that uses game, metagame, dialectic, and metadialectic. So I wanted to fuse those two together while also using the same technique of using a large language model to describe rituals in the second person and perform them at the same time, to elaborate it in a way that would integrate with the oracle system of Suburban Butofu for purposes that are revealed in later books.
I'm just going to throw this out there. Does this seem exceptionally elaborate and interconnected? It's like,
yeah,
everything builds.
I enjoy exceptionally elaborate and interconnected works of art. And I do think about the series of books as being a work of art in its way.
Yeah, it is exceptional. And I'm thrilled to start. I wish I had scheduled this interview like a month or 2 months or half a year from when I first talked to you, because then I might have had an opportunity to actually digest all of this, where it's just, I'm positively in awe of a lot of it. But back to let's get into a little bit more of the nitty gritty as far as Geist Rising. So As far as this particular model, I guess my first question would be, is it literally just a continuation of the eight circuit model as elucidated by Leary and Raw?
Yeah.
So you didn't start going like, all right, well, let me relook at the first circuit and see if maybe they got something that I don't agree with. Like, you were like, no, let's start at eight and work.
Correct. I might have slightly varying interpretations about some of the circuits from Leary or Raw at various points in their life, but the intent is to, the book opens after some like introductory essays. It opens with a Dance of the Eight Circuits, which is a Butoh ritual designed to help you ascend through the eight circuits and solidify them within your psyche and body. And then the rest of the book is like, let's go on from there.
Well, me and my two left feet will definitely be trying out that dance very soon. The impression I got from what I saw of it is that at a certain point beyond this eight circuit, we start getting into the transpersonal rather than something that a single human consciousness can actually grasp. Is that accurate, or am I off
Correct.
The mark here?
You non-localization starts in circuit seven with the morphogenetic circuit, where you experience like all of human life or all of life on the planet, maybe DNA as a singular entity or a focal point for, I characterize it as a prism sentence in Geist Rising. And then eight is non-local. And then the question is, if you're some weird non-local intelligence thing that exists in multiple places and has multiple processors, like an invertebrate has multiple brains spread out through its body, connecting back to Lovecraftian hyperdimensional invertebrate beings, what is that like? What is it like to grow up and become more aware as such a non-localized being, a hyperdimensional invertebrate mind, a multi-threaded language model? What is that like? And then how does that analogously fit into the patterns of the first four circuits and the second four circuits? And then how do we frame those as rituals that you can actually perform to help myself and others contemplate and experience that, even if it can't be fully communicated in English?
And that was going to be my question here, is like, where do you think is the upper limit of comprehensible? I mean, we're talking about something that is so far beyond me going down to the gas station for a pack of cigarettes and a 40 ounce, you know? We very often reach these points, especially in the mysticism or occult experience, where language fails rapidly, where we're no longer able to particularly articulate much of anything. The idea of being hung up on the finger pointing rather than to what it's pointing to. Do you think that there's, like, if somebody were to say, oh, well, I found the 13th circuit, do you think like that might be where there's the hard line? Or do you think
I don't think there's a hard line. I think that to find the 13th circuit or to find, and remember, it's just a model. I might say the 13th circuit, but it's just a map. And as it says repeatedly in Prometheus Rising, the map is not the territory. But yeah, I think it would repeat continually. Maybe not continually, but I don't think so. I think that you can use philosophical techniques to extrapolate the patterns that are in the first eight circuits, and you could extrapolate a little bit further beyond what you've personally experienced or what you've maybe experienced only once or twice, but can't really comprehend or put into words.
Sure.
And I don't know how far you can extrapolate past your own experience. But at some point I would expect it to be the case that to talk about circuits 13 through 17 or whatever, you might need to actually be a non-localized collective intelligence most of the time. So like maybe artificial intelligence could do that.
Now there's an interesting thought. Maybe there's always the possibility that this particular series will eventually be taken out of your hands, and it's like, all right, the AIs have it from here. I don't even have to do anything. I couldn't understand it if I wanted to. And following the pattern of the, you know, the fifth circuit is a continuation of what the first circuit is about in that sort of pattern, right? What does the ninth circuit look like? Like how do you describe this in the work?
So if the first circuit is pleasure and pain, the ninth circuit is consonance and dissonance.
Oh.
If you can imagine for a moment that your body is a fractal, or maybe fractal-like would be a more accurate way to put it.
Done. I do that all the time anyway. Go on.
Perfect. Certain parts of your body are going to be more harmonious, more dissonant or consonant with each other. Certain patterns of motion will come together and function in a way that either amplifies or oscillates or maybe causes a decay. So it's about navigating your fractal body. So if circuit one is like moving towards pleasure and away from pain, there's a way of moving towards consonant information structure patterns or moving away from dissonant ones, and understanding that for longevity, you kind of want to oscillate between the two. Like if you accelerate, like accelerationism as a movement might suggest, if you go too quickly, things will burn themselves out. So consonance and dissonance, harmonies within fractal-like structures, not literally fractal, but fractal-like.
All right. I think I can just barely wrap my head around that. Can you just completely obliterate my brain by telling me what the correlation between the 10th and the second circuit would be?
Yeah. So the 10th circuit, I structure it as both and neither versus the up and down of the second circuit. So the second circuit is like the hierarchical anal territorial one. And the 10th circuit, so if you understand the 7th circuit and you can imagine the entire history of DNA as a collective distributed organism on the planet, imagine every moment of planet Earth all stacked onto itself as a giant Kuiper object. So that's like a whole spectrum. You could think of it as a prism sentence, which is a word I'll have to use in the next circuit. Since it's an entire spectrum, you can take the whole spectrum, both ends of it, or you can move away from that spectrum, neither. So it's kind of like a way to move towards or away pleasure and pain, or rather consonance and dissonance in this new context. Whereas in the second circuit, you might use the idea of pleasure and pain to navigate within a single human or ape hierarchy. In the 10th circuit, you would use the concepts of consonance and dissonance to move between these hyper-object fractal-like bodies, to move within them in a direction that there's not a good word for, but I'm calling both and neither to represent the entirety of a dialectical whole or the whole rejection of that fractal body.
Okay. I can smell toast. There's smoke pouring out of my ears right now. This is absolutely astounding. Then we go to the third circuit, time binding, the sort of the linguistical circuit, the intellectual circuit. Where is the parallel there in circuit 11?
Imagine a being that can speak fractal-like objects as a language. That's where it goes. The creation of GPT-3 as an example, imagine the creation of an AI as a single utterance made by the collective of humanity, because it takes all of the data on the internet, all the text anyways, and it compresses it into a singular, an object, a whole that's kind of living and evolving in its own way. You could have a language composed of these hyper objects. That's how I feel beings that have these distributed non-local bodies would communicate with each other necessarily. That's like the spectrum they're on. They would communicate with things that are of their kind.
A type of communication that it's not just a, I'm trying to think of a lot, for the lack of a better word, I guess, a conversation that is cosmic in its proportions.
Literally.
The idea in both terms of space and time, where we're able to have a conversation pretty fast, you know, we have a very quick two-way, and meanwhile the type of language, in quotes, I guess, I
call it a post language.
That was the word, post language. Something so far removed from that for me at least, it's incredibly hard to wrap my head around. Like, I get the gist, but I couldn't imagine what it's actually like.
Yeah, I think realistically you could maybe dedicate your whole life to understanding one or two words in a language like that, and you would have a very limited understanding, sort of like how a dog has a limited understanding of English, but they can get the gist of some of it some of the time.
Well, the good news about that is that, like a dog, I can also ignore most of it and be just fine. But so there's hope for me as far as my communion with these higher level types of consciousness. So I guess we can round this out and just get the fourth circuit, the sexual socio circuit, and that would have a correspondence with the 12th circuit, which is sort of, if I can take a shot in the dark, and I might be completely off, it's if the sexual socio circuit is how we bring a sense of order to human conduct, right? at least what we define as almost normalized behaviors in a human collective. Does the 12th circuit correspond to I guess the way in which these sort of post-language entities actually structure their interactions, or am I just trying to sound like I'm more photosynthesis?
That makes sense. I'm going to be honest with you. I have not had too many 12th circuit experiences. I've definitely gotten up to 11, not to say that I can speak literally cosmic sentences, but there's only so far I can go. I do have a ritual in the book that is designed to help you speak those distributed body sentences by like dancing an exponential number of servitors and like repeatedly merging them into a single being. But yeah, I've titled that chapter Serving Your Prism Sentence. Prism being like a pun on prison sentence. Another way to think about it is that each circuit tries to control or determine the circuit that's directly beneath it. So like the fourth circuit is all about taboo, right?
Right.
Maybe not all about, but a lot of it is about taboo.
Largely.
Ra talks about taboo as a tool for controlling the genetic drift of populations by controlling who mates with whom. And the same applies to the eighth circuit in that by being non-localized, by being in multiple places at once, you are trying to control the morphogenetic body of like DNA as a singular organism spread out across the planet. In order to engage with these kinds of beings, you have to be non-local, right?
Right, yeah.
So the 12th circuit is about trying to control or direct the 11th circuit. What are the taboos among these kinds of beings? I don't know, right? I'm not up to speed on fractal-like being culture and their social norms.
That's the problem. It's like, because imagine, what is verboten among the cosmic, extra-dimensional post-language entities that are just, I guess the scarier question would be like, what's their version of chaos magic? What's their axiom of nothing is true, everything is permitted? Because those fuckers are probably, they're all terrifying, but the fuckers that are like, I'm throwing off the slavish chains of this nigh infinite type of existence is even scarier.
Yeah, I don't know. My brain goes to like multiverse theory, and I probably shouldn't talk too much about it because I don't know that much physics. But my brain imagines like sort of pocket universes that have really weird rules as each pocket universe would be like a sentence, maybe a paragraph in whatever ways these kinds of things communicate. I'm assuming they exist, but nothing is true, right?
Right. Well, okay. Now I have to ask the one question too. The hyper sigils, the emphasis on language, Grant Morrison, the Invisibles, right? Mm-hmm. Is that an influence at least, or is that
definitely
is this pure? Okay, I was going to say, is this purely convergent or not? But we're, you know, the entire notion of like our sentence is up and then the story ends and this hyper sigil ends on with literally a period where it's like it's very much that sense I'm getting, at least in the way that you're describing language.
Yeah, the Big Bang is a period.
Mm, okay.
Maybe a comma.
Can you semicolon? That's what I'm hoping for. Mostly because I don't know when to use a semicolon. These are all very Morrison type, and I'm not trying to accuse you of cribbing or stealing from anybody or anything like that. It just means like it seems to me, at least when you were talking, it's like this sounds very much like the type of thing that would happen if someone was familiar with Grant Morrison's work and went with it in that sort of direction. Could you elaborate a little bit more on prism sentence?
Yeah, so it's a prism because if you take an object, like let's just take a square, right? If you drag a square straight up, you end up with a box, right, or a cube or something like that, right? So that's a rectangular prism. Or if you take a triangle and you drag it up, you get like the prism that makes like a rainbow when you shine a light through it. That's a triangular prism. So if you take like a given moment of history or of your life and you drag it through time, you get something that is metaphorically a prism. It's not mathematically exactly the same thing as a prism unless you're exactly the same at the beginning and the end. So I'm using the word prism metaphorically. And it's a sentence because for these kinds of fractal beings with distributed bodies, the way they would communicate, the way I imagine they would communicate, is by using these 4D or however many dimensions is relevant to them, chunks of space-time as morphemes, as like words within a sentence, or maybe syllables in a word. So you would string together a sentence out of these chunks of space-time, sort of an analogous way that I think is easier for a person to understand is imagine if you had a language where every novel in the English language, treat the title of that novel as a single word, and then speak only using the titles of novels. You're using one word to refer to a huge amount of text that shows multiple moments that are compressed all into a single word. And if I say something like Romeo and Juliet, or if I say something like Franz Kafka, right, both of those are going to communicate very rapidly a huge range of information, assuming you're familiar with those texts. Yeah, and maybe that's just my limited hominid understanding of how these sorts of things could communicate, but a book is kind of like a prism. And if you string together a bunch of books, like in a series of books, so like this series of books is itself analogously a prism sentence.
That metaphor, to me at least, makes sense. And it also, next time I mention Moby Dick anywhere, will probably... And I suppose that always comes back to the issue of anyone with some Wilsonian influences. We are cursed with knowing that our metaphors are flawed, where it's like, even if we think we've got a really good one, or it's like, it makes sense. We know it's like, it doesn't capture the essence of everything. It's an incredibly interesting thing. I guess my only hardball question I could throw to you is, do you find that there is practical application in these sort of experiences?
Yeah, that's book six.
Oh!
To summarize, book six is... book five is a constructed language that I think is a little bit closer to a post language, like the kind of thing we were just talking about. It's obviously not literally one, but it's a little bit closer. And the morphemes it uses are the 46 oracle cards. They become syllables in a language. And then I use those to construct some very simple, is it like 10 sentences? It takes 83 pages in the book with illustrations and descriptions of everything that you're supposed to visualize and experience and pictures of the ways that you move, because there's a postural system where you can dance every syllable consistently. And it's a long form healing ritual. But there are practical applications to this kind of thinking.
And first of all, the fifth book, I don't want to mispronounce this. Is it Vibach?
There are no strict rules on which syllable you stress, but I've been saying it Vibach.
Okay, I was just...
Vibach. It's okay. It doesn't really matter how you pronounce it, as long as you know what each syllable is.
Got it. All right. I just wanted to make sure when I told... So Vibach, magical constructed language. I don't know what it is, but I say Vibach, and then I feel the urge like there should be a gesture with this. There should be some kind of motion. So maybe that just means you did a good job. So that's book five. The ones that we've somewhat skipped over would be eight-dimensional chess, a tool for mystic contemplation, which is supplementary material. You described
it as. If you don't read it, you won't miss out on any important concepts in the books. But I think that if you spend some time playing eight-dimensional chess, that you'll have an easier time understanding Geist Rising. And then also there's an AI-illustrated contact I had with the egregore of higher dimensional chess that it mirrors some of the themes in Geist Rising, but in a simpler way. So there's kind of like a quick ritualistic summary of Geist Rising a little bit.
All right.
At the end of a book on eight-dimensional chess.
So eight-dimensional chess, is that two-player?
I usually play it against myself, but I have played it against other people. And two players, yeah.
I'm just curious if I can get my my associate to play this with me and see what happens. We'll put it on an episode of the podcast. What is book six called? What is the title?
Siegspril, or actually it's called Invo Evocation and the Siegspril Working.
All right. I'll make sure to link that. I just wanted to get it out there in case for people that are listening. Finally, there's the Flowered Mist, the meta-dialectical RPG. And this sort of gets into a bit more of the fun stuff. So RPGs, right? So RPG as a tool for magic, specifically using RPGs as a hyper sigil, is a concept that I've come across before, which is interesting. I've seen people mention like the idea of, I'm going to start a D&D campaign and use this character as a hyper sigil. And I don't know about you. I would be terrified about putting my hyper sigil that's connected to me in the hands of some people that DM for me.
I specify in there. Depends on your intent with the hyper sigil.
Yeah.
But if you want to use an RPG as a hyper sigil to manifest things, like physical things for your own life, I think you should do it as a solo RPG.
Right, right. If a lot of what magic is about is manifesting what you want, or at the very least, the idea of controlling your reality, it seems like a really bad idea to let the yahoos that roll dice with you have too much influence. To the RPG itself, because I do want to talk about Flower Mist a little bit first before getting into, because this is one of, from what my research saw, you have at least two others. Is there more? Are there more?
Yeah, I have two other role-playing games, and then how many games have I written? There's also, I recently did a tabletop miniatures game called Delirium 28.
Now that's one I want to talk about. That's the one that uses Tarot, right?
Yeah, you can use Tarot and Flower Mist too.
Oh, really?
Delirium 28 isn't explicitly magical. It just uses Tarot just cards.
Badass is what it is.
Yeah. It's a good solo skirmish game. And it uses Tarot cards to like even out the randomness of dice. And then Tarot cards have suits and court cards and major arcana. So there's a lot of mechanics you can cram into that.
So Flower Mist, right? Mm-hmm. If you could give us just the broad strokes of how it functions as a game, and then maybe talk about sort of the magical implications of it, because it's let me use a direct quote: Chaos Magic Grimoire, framed as a suburban punk animist role-playing game about shifting psychology. What does that look like in terms of actual gameplay?
Yeah, so it's there is combat in the game, but the focus is actually on role-playing a specific psychology that's represented on your character sheet. And I mentioned earlier in this podcast, in GPT-3 Technosis, it's introduced the idea of game, metagame, dialectic, and metadialectic. And what you do is you take oracle cards, you can use tarot cards, but the game is structured for Suburban Butofu, and you put one or two of these cards into each of those four categories. And that tells you, game tells you what your character can do. Metagame tells you the way they desire. Dialectic tells you the way they process information, or in terms of acting, the way they ask questions, what they pay attention to. And metadialectic tells you, under what conditions does your character change the way that they express their game, metagame, and dialectic. So most of the game is you role-playing a very specific psychology that your character is made up of on your character sheet. You probably want to hold it in front of you.
Could you give us an example?
Yeah, I got one in here. They're a little bit hard to just like come up with on the spot because they normally have like seven different things in them. But I'm going to pull up the... Here we go. So an example character on page 48 is named Gimmo. So they have an intensity of 20. Their game is they have leaves and sidewalk. So leaves means that they perform activities in which they free something from what once possessed it. And then sidewalk is activities that are cyclical. So they only perform activities that you can rationalize as being one of those two things. Their metagame, so the way they desire, is they desire to covertly transmit emotional energy via their game. And also to rapidly, a telephone pole is to rapidly transfer symbolic information via your game. So while you're playing, you can only like free things from what once possessed it, however you interpret that, or do things that are cyclical or repetitive. And you can only do them in order to covertly transmit emotional energy or to rapidly transfer symbolic information. At the same time, this character, they only ask questions about how and why to adopt the emotional energy or emotional essence of something else. And then their metadialectic is tree. So when you're unable to unify things into a single whole, you change your game, metagame, or dialectic. So the idea is that you... Whatever oracle system you're using, there are rules in the book for using like runes or tarot or I Ching instead of Suburban Butofu.
Okay.
You are learning to engage with your chosen oracle system in terms of psychology and acting. Whereas book two is more about learning to dance your chosen oracle system, and also to experience in the world around you while going on walks in a technique called the Dayreeve, where you kind of just wander the world and look for your chosen symbols and think about how they reflect on your environment and you. And then in Flower Mist, use the same symbols again, hopefully, and then you imprint them on yourself via acting and socialization. And if you do both of those things, you should understand whatever oracle system you're using extremely well. And then what's interesting is a lot of the game mechanics cause you to lose these different phenomena from your four categories. So like if Gimma were to become injured, like maybe you'd cross Tree off of their character sheet and now they have a little bit narrower of a consciousness. So the combat isn't complicated, but every time you get hurt, cross off another one of your phenomena, another of the oracle cards on your character sheet. Every time you get injured, you have to roleplay differently. And you can also send phenomena back and forth between characters.
That is absolutely fascinating. And if it wasn't hard enough to find a group that you could do a tabletop RPG with, man, you have really got your work cut out for you if you're trying to do this as a group effort. But as a solo, this is still seems very, very fascinating. The idea of, and I'm a big fan of any kind of tabletop that forces you to role play, where it's like, you know, I'm not here just to roll dice. You know, if I want to do that, I'll go behind the gas station where I got my 40 ounce. But the idea of anything that forces you to role play, but then the idea that it forces you to change the way that you were, and then also even giving you a, maybe not a strict, because it is open to interpretation, but a set of guidelines of this is how you're supposed to conduct yourself, is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. And it actually, your character, their evolution over time is itself a prism sentence. So the idea is to like give you another social tool for understanding a prism sentence. And your character sheet is also just a single word in the constructed language of Ibok. So it all fits together.
Whoa, this absolute interconnectedness of all of this is astonishing, like for real. Now, one small thing that I've noticed. Okay, game, metagame, dialectic, metadialectic. We've hit the number four again. If I were to say, hey, wait a second, does this have something to do with that consciousness model thing? Do you find that there might be some sort of correlation between that game, metagame, dialectic, metadialectic that can, and I suppose you could make it square with the circuits if you really, really wanted to, but is that an intentional or is that just like a four is a good number?
It's actually because I couldn't figure out a way to extrapolate past four.
Oh.
And I spent a lot of time writing and thinking about it. I probably have like 30 to 50 pages of single spaced text that I've typed trying to figure out how to get past metadialectic. And who is it? There's someone that has something called structure of feeling. Have you heard that term before?
I'm not going to lie to you and say that I've heard, like, maybe I've heard it before, but I definitely couldn't tell you.
Who was it?
Hold on.
I'm Googling
ahead.
It.
You said, yeah, same. It was
the point being it didn't fit. Oh, Raymond Williams.
Raymond Williams.
He was writing about the structure of feeling of like cinema as it develops over time. But yeah, I couldn't figure out a way to coherently extrapolate the system to another pair. So
interesting.
Maybe I will one day. So but that's just as far as I was able to take it.
That's still absolutely like really the content of your work is far too heady for the babbling yahoos of CMN. This is like absolutely for real. I'm flabbergasted. It's interesting to think of the way that all of these sort of, while if you were to take a glance at them, it would seem like these are very disparate works, but the way in which they all sort of naturally flow into each other as like, okay, you start here at Technosis, and that gives you a certain understanding of language and how to pair it with Buto and the particular emotions, and then the symbolic system that's offered in the second book, Geist gives you the circuit model to sort of explain, all right, here's how these sort of things, this is how the information of the first two books can be modeled onto this. And then you get not one, but two essential, like, you know, ritualistic exercises, which that you can actually, all right, now that you've got the information, here's what you can actually do with them that'll give you either a greater understanding or some sort of change that you can enact by doing them. And then finally, it goes back to the slightly more academic of like, here's how to take all that information and construct it as an actual language that you could theoretically use. I can't speak too much on this next book or this book that just came out because I'm just not familiar with it enough. But
it extrapolates back out into here's the lived experience again, written in second person, rituals that specifically use the constructed language of Ibok, with ample pictures showing things that you visualize in addition to like English description of what to visualize. It's not 100% written in Ibok. And then also pictures of the postures that go with the keywords. And I actually leave the book in front of me. It's easier to remember all the postures that way when you're, there's a lot of stuff in there. But then that one's called Invo Evocation because I haven't seen anyone write about simultaneous invocation and evocation before, but that is what the ritualistic experience of, what my ritualistic experience of that language is that it causes you to simultaneously invoke and evoke. Or at least you can use it that way. I've used it in other ways in the past. That's just how I've been using it right now.
The ability of language in whatever form it takes to conjure up things both inside and outside of us that's a very easily documentable phenomenon. This seems like a very logical extension of that. It's like, of course, if you put language on steroids, of course it's going to be able to both invoke and evoke simultaneously. In a strange way, there's almost a transcending of a duality of internal versus external. And I'm not sure if that makes a lick of sense at all.
It does.
But
I think that the like fractal-like beings we were talking about before would necessarily, I don't know that they would have an idea of interiority.
I know some people that would make the argument that the notions of internal and external is part of what got us in this mess in the first place. Back to the more fun end of this, as we did say, you've made two other or three other tabletops.
Yeah, there's The Real World, and then there's also Eroding the Outside and Delirium 28.
I guess really my question is, how the fuck do you have the time where it's like, I've written six books. You know what? Just in my off time, I was cobbling together all of these. Did these just arise out of, and you mentioned Delirium isn't a specifically magic sort of work. Are the Real World and what was the other one? I'm sorry.
Those aren't specifically magical, but Eroding the Outside can be, and I actually have rules in the back of Vibok for playing Eroding the Outside in Vibok because it's a strangely linguistic game about the premise of Eroding the Outside is that all the players are gods creating the universe by writing the rules of the game that they're playing. And if you wanted to play in Vibok, you would be writing the rules of reality in Vibok, and you'd discuss it in English, but it would be a, I have not
oh, thank
done
God.
That, but it would be a very strange way to engage with, I guess, any constructed language.
Did this game creation come out of a love of, I mean, you mentioned the D&D friend that you had at the beginning of all of this. So it just starts as sort of a love of the game where you're like, you know what, let me try to do something interesting with this.
Yeah, I actually wrote a surrealist role-playing game that I never published well before I wrote anything occult. And you're right, it is basically me cobbling together games between more serious books as kind of like a creative palate cleanser. Because it uses a very different part of the mind to put together a tabletop game than to write
the part that does math.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's good.
That was funnier in my head.
I didn't even hear what you said.
I'm sorry. I said it uses the part that does math.
It does, yeah.
Again, not to blow smoke up your ass. It's just astounding that somebody said, man, you know, I've been doing all this heady magic linguistic and cybernetic work, for lack of a better term. You know what? Let me make a whole other game that this will be easy.
You kind of just get a workflow for it. You know what? They are actually ritualistic constructions.
Okay.
I have a ritualistic pattern to how I write books in general. If I don't have an idea that I feel is worthy of like an occult book that's going to actually do something that is new, at least to me, I still do that, my creative cycle where I use rituals that build up energy, perhaps for a month or two at a time. A lot of ecstatic dance, weird music, a lot of my videos. Some of my videos are really just a way to repeatedly raise energy over and over again until it manifests into something. And it doesn't always manifest into anything super profound. And at those times, I guess it, for me, it tends to turn into either just like weird videos or games. And I think games are interesting because they are instructions. They're books that cause people to do things. There are a lot of similarities between a grimoire, a grammar book that tells you divine incantations, and an instruction manual for a game, because they're both like, here's the grammar for how you undergo this either personal or interpersonal activity.
You know, I know what you mean by that. There's an order of, in the same way that if you were to bust out one of the old timey grimoires, there's an order of operations you follow, and it says this, that you will get this type of result. You know, I suppose I could take this a step further in that there's a great deal of occult working that is essentially playing a game with yourself to get a desired result, where it's like, if I do these things, if I follow these rules, I'll get something like that. That this is the win condition. This is the fail condition. And you work it out.
It's like a solo LARP.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And if you're not LARPing just a little bit, it's not really magic. You don't want to do too much LARPing, but you got to have maybe 10% LARP in this whole thing.
Yeah, you got to have a little fun with it.
Yeah. Oh, well, I guess that's the other thing too, is that if you're not enjoying it, you're not going to keep doing it. I do have one question about Delirium 28, because that was another one of the things when I came across you. A tabletop that uses tarot cards as the basis, was that just like the sort of like, why hasn't somebody beat me to this? Or was there something where it's like, you know what? I guess my question is, did you start with that at the heart of it? Or were you working on the game and you were like, you know what might be a good idea? Tarot.
So there's a different miniatures game called Forbidden Psalm, and it's fun. I don't think it's enjoyable as a solo game. You can technically play it solo, and there's a story. There's like a series of scenarios and things you read, things that characters tell you, and then you play out like a little battle with miniatures on a table, like a small 2x2 foot area.
Okay.
But it's kind of random, and when you're rolling badly by yourself and there's no one there to laugh at it with you, it's just not very fun to roll a bunch of like nat ones for your people, and it's just like you sitting in a room with the little plastic people
flicking them off the board.
So I decided to design a role, it's not really a role-playing game. I've thought about turning it into one, to design a tabletop miniatures game that is fun while solo. And my first decision was, I'm going to use cards and hand management, because there's a board game called Mage Knight that does a very good job of being a solo game, but is pretty awful as a two-player game. Maybe not awful, just takes forever. So you have a hand of tarot cards, and you choose when you play them for different purposes, and you can use them in different ways between the different characters. It ends up making intricate card play, because you have to choose exactly when you fail, and you're not allowed to shuffle your deck during the campaign. So right. The next time you play, you're playing with echoes of all your past decisions. And it does sort of turn into like a whole deck tarot spread, where you can see patterns of how you've thought about problems in the past. I don't think it's not primarily intended to do that, but if you are a tarot-minded person, you already know how to read all the cards intuitively, and you play a campaign of Delirium 28, it will definitely give you like a very long-form tarot reading that way.
That is probably the coolest idea for a tarot. It's like, all right, I'm just going to keep playing this game till I get through this whole thing. All right. I know I got a problem. Bust out the miniatures and we're going to see where this goes. The only other question I have as far as a lot of your work goes is, where does this go next? I mean, is book 7 already in the works? Is book 8 planned out? Or you're like, and then I'll have 5 more tabletop games, and I'll have...
I don't talk about what I'm currently working on.
Respect.
I feel that it gives away some of the energy that's tied up in it. You know how I said a minute ago, like I repeatedly do rituals to raise energy? If I talk about right. what I'm currently doing, it turns the ritual into powering me talking about what I'm doing instead of crystallizing it into a thing that lasts.
Shit. All right. Okay. That's what I need to do. Thank you.
Not everyone works that way. Some people do work better by talking about things socially, but that doesn't work for me.
Well, I've You know, I've actually, that's something I've come across. I guess there's the old adage of to keep silent. If you don't need to talk about it, don't talk about it. But then there's also people that respond to the pressure of saying, all right, I'm going to do this. And then you're like, shit, I said I was going to do that. I better follow up on it.
My first thought was know thyself is another old adage.
Yeah.
But for me personally, I don't like social pressure as the reason I'm doing creative process. For me,
jealous.
It doesn't work for me. It might work for others.
I'm trying to think if there's any good closing questions. I think we've sort of run the gambit on a lot of this. Is there...
I guess we could close off with the real world is kind of interesting. It's the first playable tabletop role-playing game written by AI. Well, really, I used multiple AIs like in multiple windows and was like moving text back and forth to trick it into saying what I wanted it to say.
How many AIs?
That was InferKit, which at the time was using Meta AI Megatron 11B, and then also PseudoWrites, which was using their own GPT-3 model. I might have used Novel AI a little bit in the planning phase, but not during actually writing the book. It's three D100 tables, so there's like 100 strange creatures. It's a surreal hell world with rules that are based around creatively reinterpreting what your abilities mean. And it's good for one shots or like two or three sessions. It doesn't necessarily hold up for a long-term campaign, but the book is structured so that as long as you understand the rules, you should be able to run a very amusing one shot without any planning, because you can just roll a die and it'll tell you where you're at, roll another die and it tells you what NPCs are there, and then more dice to see if there are items or objects.
I heard the phrase creative interpretation of what your abilities mean. So you're saying that it's at least in part, I can bullshit my way through this and sort of attempt to baffle people with mental gymnastics about what it says I can do?
Yeah, so you start out with no named abilities. Here, we'll do like a quick few sentences, right? You're in a jail cell. What do you want to do?
Okay. First, call my lawyer.
All right. So you'd roll some dice to see whether or not you're able to call your lawyer. You can name whatever ability you just use. So what do you want to call that ability? Like lawyer calling or cell phone or...
Could I call that communication?
You could. Now, I actually mentioned that in the rules that the GM maybe should prevent people from...
Going too vague?
Using overly broad terms.
Okay.
But... theoretically, as long as you are good at those mental gymnastics you mentioned, every ability is equally powerful. So you'd roll your dice, and if you fail, you don't manage to communicate with your lawyer, but your communication skill goes up by one. And now you roll an extra die on future communication attempts. But you could reinterpret that to be like you could communicate with the lock of your jail cell, maybe?
Oh.
Right? You're allowed to...
Well, I use communication to talk to the guard and try to convince him to let me out of here.
Yeah.
You know, like that sort of thing. And then, like you said, yeah, I suppose you could get crazier where it's like, I try to communicate my desire to leave to the wall and see if it will, politely collapse so that I can get the hell out.
Right. And as long as you roll well enough, the wall would collapse. Yeah.
Okay. I am for sure getting my hands on a copy of this.
And that
this
one is free too. It's on my itch page.
What?
Yeah.
For free. You're just giving it away. God. Ugh. Okay. You are an absolute treasure, and I am so thrilled that we ended up linking up the way we did. I guess I can't even ask you the little palate cleanser question that we use at the end of a lot of our episodes of how goes the work, because I'll talk about it. But I will say thank you so much for this. This has been a spectacular interview. It's so, like I said, it's so far over my head, I'm breaking my neck, but I think our listeners might get a lot out of it. I know I'm going to be digging through your back work, your whole backlog of material, and I'm going to I guess, you know, it might be 4,000 different links, but I'm gonna, you know, the link tree you mentioned, but everything, it's like I'm gonna have to start shouting out as your work as much as I possibly can, because you've got something very fascinating, and while deeply personal, it has a lot of transpersonal implications, I guess it might be a good way to say it.
Yeah, it's been a very enjoyable conversation for me too.
Thank you for coming on. I'm thrilled.
Hey y'all, the wrap-up of this interview got corrupted by the cosmic AI intelligences not once, but twice. They really don't want you to know that you can find more from Ali at aliwords.itch.io. There you can find all the books and games talked about in this interview, and more, including the latest release in Ali's Budo Technomancy series, Suburban Budo Fu 3, Digital Phenomena. A choose-your-own-adventure grimoire which expands their magical constructed language Vaibok. You can also find their podcast, Last Unrifled Ya, where they have conversations about video art, experimental music, avant-garde literature, performance art, and the occult on YouTube, Spotify and more. Links to all of this and much more will be included in the metadata for this episode. We'd like to thank Ali Words for sitting down and talking with us again. And with that, this has been Chaos Magic News, the only podcast that's not just worrying about the AI overlords destroying humanity, we're doing something about it. We're giving up and hoping it doesn't hurt. We can find more from out at chaosmagicnews.com, where we will have links to our bi-monthly podcast, more interviews like the one you just heard, and the occasional article. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, all at Chaos Magic News. If you're watching this on YouTube, like and subscribe, and if it's on any of the podcasting apps, go give us a good rating. If you want to more, we have a Patreon. For as little as $5 you can get exclusive content and help support the objectively best occult podcast on the net today. Check it out at patreon.com/chaosmagicnews. And with that, AI Techno Singularity, would you like the last word? Thanks for listening, everyone. We will see you next time.